From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, reforming capital punishment. We talk with former federal prosecutor and best-selling novelist Scott Turow and state's attorney Mike Waller. They served on the commission created by Illinois Governor George Ryan to recommend ways of reforming the death penalty system. Last month, before leaving office, Governor Ryan commuted the sentences of all death row inmates in Illinois. Turow says serving on the commission led him to change his mind and become a death penalty opponent. Waller still supports the death penalty. The death penalty coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration may propose a new resolution to the UN Security Council that would endorse the use of military action to disarm Iraq. President Bush said a second resolution could be useful, but it's not necessary.
We don't need a second resolution. It's clear this guy could even care less about the first resolution. He's in total defiance of 1441. But we want to work with our friends and allies to see if we can get a second resolution. That's what we're doing right now.
The president also said that he's not been influenced by massive anti-war protests around the world. Meanwhile, the Vatican is attempting to use diplomacy to avert a conflict. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
The Pope today met UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Earlier, the Secretary General warned Baghdad to move very fast and cooperate fully with UN weapons inspectors or face a possible war. Yesterday, Annan had said that the international community must agree on a course of action against Iraq or the legitimacy of military action would be impaired. Earlier, the Pope was briefed by his peace envoy to Iraq, Cardinal Roger Etchegaray. In an interview yesterday, the cardinal had said he is convinced peace is possible and that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is very open to dialogue. He did not reveal the substance of his talks, but he said he had urged Saddam to exert himself to the maximum to avoid armed conflict. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Chicago police are looking for the promoter of a nightclub event where 21 people died in a stampede. Police Superintendent Terry Hillard identified the promoter as Marco Flores.
We understand that he took a plane out of town yesterday, and we don't know if that was a pre-planned event or if he just really got out because of this incident.
Chicago officials say the club was violating a court order that shut it down because of repeated building violations, including too few exits. City lawyer Mara Georges disputed lawyers for the nightclub owners who said they'd reached a deal with the city to remain open.
Here we have people who were bent on breaking the law, people who felt that they could get around a court order, and the tragedy ensued as a result of their actions.
The panic apparently started when security guards used pepper spray to break up a fight. Much of the Northeast is digging out from the weekend's record snowstorm. The blizzard left between 2 and 4 feet of snow in its wake, burying cars and blocking streets. Schools are closed in an area stretching from West Virginia to Connecticut. Authorities blame the storm for at least 37 deaths. Boston measured a record 27.5 inches of snow so far, the most since record-keeping began back in 1892. Meltoff from the snow has already begun triggering mudslides and floods in the southern Appalachian Mountains. In stocks today, the Dow gained 132 points to close at 8,041. This is NPR News. The new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission promised today to punish corporate criminals and demand responsible behavior from the business and financial world. William Donaldson was sworn in today by President Bush, who said he'd be a forceful advocate of the interests of investors. Pills that can provide some protection from radiation in the event of a nuclear accident are proving unusually popular with residents who live near an Ohio nuclear power plant. Karen Schaefer reports from member station WCPN in Cleveland.
The federal government is giving potassium iodide pills to residents in 17 states who live within 10 miles of a nuclear power plant. About 20,000 people live near the Davis-Bessey nuclear plant near Toledo. The plant was shut down by federal regulators a year ago after workers found a football-sized hole in the lid of the reactor. Ottawa County Emergency Management Director Jim Greer says the number of requests for potassium iodide has been surprising.
We expected roughly 10% of the eligible population to actually come in and want the potassium iodide tablets. And it's turned out so far to be more like a third of the population has come forward and requested them.
Greer thinks increased worries about terrorism may also be a contributing factor. For NPR News, I'm Karen Schaefer in Cleveland.
Police in South Korea say at least 120 people were killed and nearly 140 were injured yesterday when a man lit a carton of flammable material in a crowded subway car. Police are questioning a suspect who's said to have a history of mental illness. The attack took place in Daegu, South Korea's third largest city. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 36 points to close at 1,346. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching. BreakthroughCollaborative.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The death penalty remains a controversial and divisive issue. Last month, just before leaving office, Illinois Governor George Ryan took a stand by pardoning four condemned men and commuting the sentences of the remaining 167 prisoners on Illinois' death row. 2 years earlier, the governor imposed a moratorium on executions and appointed a commission to examine the fairness of the death penalty. The commission released its findings last April and recommended 80 changes in the way the death penalty is administered. Later, we'll hear from a state's attorney who served on the commission and continues to support the death penalty. First, we'll talk about serving on the commission with Scott Turow. Turow is a lawyer and the author of several best-selling legal thrillers, including Presumed Innocent. His latest novel, Reversible Errors, is about a lawyer trying to exonerate a man facing imminent execution. When you joined this commission, you say you were a supporter of the death penalty. What were your reasons at the time for supporting the death penalty?
I don't know if I would call myself a supporter of the death penalty. I used to refer to myself as a death penalty agnostic. But I do think that...
What does that mean? I'm not sure what that means.
Well, it meant that I was constantly vacillating, but there were certainly days when I called myself a supporter of capital punishment. I know that when I was asked to protest the execution of John Wayne Gacy, who had killed 33 young men in the most horrible means imaginable, and then buried their tortured bodies under his house, that I refused to join in the protests. I couldn't call executing Gacy an injustice. So I was never settled in my own mind, though, whether capital punishment, while just in terms of my own moral lexicon, whether it was wise as a matter of legal procedure and a way to run a society.
Now, when you were... prosecuting cases, there was no federal death penalty at the time, and you were a federal assistant U.S. attorney.
Correct.
But then you became a defense attorney,
right,
with a private practice, and by this
right.
time there was a death penalty. Did you have cases in which were capital cases in which you were defending the person?
Well, my exposure to capital punishment really came in a couple of doses. For many years, I represented a man named Alex Hernandez, who, along with his more celebrated co-defendant, Rolando Cruz, had been tried, convicted, and sentenced to death once. Their case was reversed, and Cruz was retried, sentenced to death again, Hernandez to 80 years. And I came in at the point that Hernandez had been sentenced to 80 years. So I was handling the appeal from a capital prosecution, but my client was not death sentenced. His co-defendant was. The great controversy came after both Hernandez and Cruz had been convicted and sentenced to death when another man, Brian Dugan, confessed that he, in fact, had committed the crime for which these two men were then on death row. A claim in Dugan's case that was obviously buttressed by the fact that he had committed other murders, one of which nearly identical to the crime involved for Cruz and Hernandez. And the response of the prosecutors to this new information about Dugan was certainly disappointing to me as a defense lawyer. They resisted Dugan's confession for a decade, attempting to debunk it, calling him a liar, when they couldn't prevail any longer on the idea that he was uninvolved because of DNA tests, then they started to suggest that Cruz and Hernandez must have committed the crime with him. And as I say, it was a classic example of watching prosecutors get dug into a theory and then basically losing, in my opinion, any sense of boundary in trying to vindicate that original judgment.
So what was the final outcome in this case?
Well, the final outcome is complicated, but the short answer is that Cruz and Hernandez are free. Seven individuals, four police officers and three prosecutors, were indicted for conspiring to obstruct justice in the Cruz case. They were tried and they were acquitted, but the county reached a multimillion-dollar civil settlement with Hernandez, Cruz, and their one-time co-defendant, a man named Stephen Buckley, who'd been indicted with them originally.
So was this case a turning point for you in terms of your opinions about the death penalty?
The case was a turning point for me in my opinions about the justice system. Like most people who have been prosecutors, I always assumed that I had certainly never taken anybody to trial whom I thought was innocent. And I really believed that the justice system operated, perhaps not perfectly, but I thought it was extremely unlikely that you could convict an innocent person, let alone once. But the idea that it could be done twice seemed completely ridiculous and inconceivable to me. And I think there's, you know, something in the nature of the kinds of cases that end up as capital cases, cases in which the death penalty is sought, that makes them more prone to convict innocent people.
What is that?
It's sort of a paradox that troubles the capital system. The cases in which capital punishment is supposed to be sought are, you know, to borrow an often used phrase most recently employed by the Virginia prosecutor who's trying the Beltway sniper case, it's supposed to be the worst of the worst. These are the most offensive, most repellent crimes, whose facts are often deeply upsetting. In the case of Hernandez and Cruz, a 10-year-old girl had been abducted from her home in broad daylight, sexually abused, and then beaten to death. And the problem is that these cases stir up deep anxieties and enormous anger. And that combination of anxiety and anger puts pressure on police and prosecutors to come up with suspects, and also makes it hard for judges and juries to make dispassionate decisions in these cases. And the irony is that the worse the case, the more likely you are, the way our system operates, to convict innocent people.
What are some of the things that you saw when you served on the Governor's Commission investigating the death penalty that affected your point of view about the death penalty?
Well, you know, in this state, we've now had 17 people who have been sentenced to death and later legally absolved, in most cases with convincing proof of innocence. And you really sit back and you go, how could this happen and how could it happen so often? And certainly the largest problem is the one that I just identified, at least in my opinion, which is that, you know, the cases themselves are basically a trap for the innocent because they're so emotional. But beyond that, in these 17 cases in Illinois, the certainly most prevalent problem was what you'd have to call false confessions. You know, as a prosecutor, I sort of subscribed to the belief that nobody would ever confess to a crime they didn't commit. And it turns out that there are various circumstances where that does happen.
You mean because it's beaten out of them?
Well, you know, beating is one thing. You know, Gary Gauger, though, who's one of the 13, or one of the now 17, excuse me, but Gary Gauger, whose case is dramatized in the play The Exonerated, Gauger found the bodies of his parents and was immediately taken by the police as a suspect. He was then interrogated for 12 hours, and in that state of mind began speculating about how the crime might have occurred, and the police treated that as a confession. So you're really looking at interrogation techniques there that risked false statement. That happened more than once. That was certainly something that was true in Hernandez's case as well. You know, he made constant wild statements. Alex's IQ was debated, but nobody thought it was much above 80. And he was constantly put in circumstances where he was trying to help the police and saying absolutely goofy things, but the police ultimately picked and chose among those statements and said, well, this proves that he's guilty.
You pointed out that some people support the death penalty because it suits their sense of moral proportion, that a serious and heinous, repulsive crime, a monstrous offense, should also have the most severe penalty,
right,
execution. But after research and after serving on this commission, I think you no longer think that that sense of moral proportion really holds up.
The problem with it is that you can't carry it out in practice. It puts an enormous burden of precision on the justice system. If you sentence to death people who are not guilty or whose crimes are less grave than other people who get life sentences, for example, then you have not reinforced any kind of proportionate morality. You've undermined it. And in point of fact, that's exactly what we do. Certainly, we did commission research in Illinois that showed differential treatment, for example, not just based on race, which is a complicated subject, but geography, gender. All of these things change the rates at which people get sentenced to death, and certainly race is another factor, although it doesn't operate so much on the skin color of the defendant so much as on the skin color of the victim. But again, if you kill a white person in this society, or at least in the state of Illinois historically, you're 3.5 more times likely to get a death sentence than if you kill somebody black.
And if you kill them in a rural area, you're more likely to get the death penalty
more
than
likely
in the city.
Five times more likely in a rural area. I think it's 2.5 more times likely if you kill a woman, half as likely if you are a woman. All of these factors play in, and you think that it's ultimate punishment for ultimate evil, but it ends up being far more capricious than that.
My guest is lawyer and best-selling novelist Scott Turow. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Scott Turow. He's a lawyer and the author of several best-selling legal thrillers. We're talking about his experiences serving on an Illinois state commission to reform the death penalty. Well, one of the problems with the system is that people who have been convicted turned out to not have done the murder. And one of the reasons why we know that is that after the fact, DNA has been used in the reinvestigation of certain cases, and
right,
it's shown that the person who was found guilty didn't do the crime. So in the short term, DNA evidence is an argument against the death penalty because we're proving that people were unjustly convicted. You could argue that in the long term, DNA evidence will help support the death penalty because now we'll be more certain that the people convicted of a crime actually did the crime. Do you think that your point of view about the death penalty will change as DNA becomes more widely used?
Well, I think that the argument you just made is unfortunately specious. DNA has sort of exposed the tip of the iceberg. It has shown us that in many, many cases of violent crime, these kinds of cases that excite the emotions, we've convicted the wrong people. The Central Park jogger case is, you know, an example from outside of Illinois. But lay people tend to make the assumption that, well, you have DNA in every case. In point of fact, you do not have DNA in every case. Generally speaking, there's not always genetic evidence left behind. You know, it's got to be blood, saliva, semen, something like that. So while DNA is exposed in a really troubling way the fallacies of the system, it is not the case that we're going to be able to tell innocent from guilty simply because of that scientific innovation or any other. To a great extent, the system still depends upon the testimony of eyewitnesses, of accomplices. Those are the means we've got. And I'm not proposing that we shut down the criminal justice system, but we have to be aware of its vagaries.
Do you think that the death penalty has looked different to you from the point of view of prosecutor than it's looked from the point of view of defense attorney?
Sure. I mean,
what are some of the differences?
Well, bear in mind, and I try to remind myself of this all the time, and we talk appropriately about the propensity of the innocent to be convicted in capital cases. But the reality, of course, is that most defendants who are convicted in the United States are still guilty. And when you are a prosecutor, your day-to-day experience is not of struggling to convict the innocent, but, of course, struggling against all of the barriers that the system imposes to convict the guilty. But when you get on the other side and you're suddenly charged with dealing with an individual case, of course, it can look much different. And one of the real problems we've got in this country is that we're basically, especially in our big cities, engaged in a system of wholesale justice.
What do you mean by wholesale justice?
The demands on the system are huge. You go into, for example, a courtroom in the state courts in Chicago. Every judge has got 100 active criminal cases on his docket, at least 100, many of them involving lots of serious violence. You can't take all those cases to trial. You have to get guilty pleas. There's a tremendous impetus to sort of push those cases through the system. By the same token, we can sit and talk about DNA and scientific evidence, but if you're a police officer who's dealing with crime by volume, the easiest way to clear a case is to get a confession, not to go out and take DNA specimens and wait 6 weeks for the results to come back. And in that context, if there's a premium, for example, on confessions, and there is, that's an obvious temptation to employ over-aggressive means in getting those confessions.
The Commission to Reform the Death Penalty that you served on at the request of Governor Ryan of Illinois issued a bunch of recommendations. Select what you consider to be the most important ones.
Well, there were several. The big-ticket items in my mind, though, are videotaping of interrogations. That means that as soon as somebody is a suspect in a murder, that everything the police do with that person in the station house is videotaped, so that that eliminates both the coercion and the claims of coercion. We recommended greatly reducing the eligibility factors in Illinois. When the death penalty was passed here in 1977, there were 7 factual circumstances under which capital punishment could be sought. There are now 20, and one of them, felony murder, has gone from 9 felonies that made you eligible to 16. We recommended dramatically reducing that number and getting rid of felony murder. We recommended a statewide commission review the election of any of the 102 state's attorneys in Illinois who have the power now to seek the death penalty. We did that to make sure that there was better uniformity in the way that laws are applied, so you don't get the death penalty being sought 5 times more often in rural areas. We recommended changing the way eyewitness identifications and lineups are conducted. And then we also sort of said to the people of Illinois, if you want to have a death penalty, you must be willing to pay for it. The fact of the matter is that capital punishment is more expensive than the alternatives. You have to be willing to fund defenses, and the state has made a good start in that direction. You have to have qualified lawyers who, generally speaking, require compensation. You have to have experts. You have to have psychologists. Your state has to pay for that in most instances. You have to have better training for police, for judges, for defense lawyers.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think most people assume if you kill the offender, it's cheaper than maintaining them in prison.
Right. Just one of many false assumptions about the death penalty. This has been studied in a number of different jurisdictions. The most recent one was done in our neighboring state of Indiana, where they figured that in terms of present dollars, it's about 35% more expensive to impose a capital sentence on somebody.
Have you spent much time on death row?
Well, I've certainly been there, yeah. You know, I don't know what qualifies as much time, but I've probably visited death row 10, 12 times, and, you know, I've stood in the execution chamber where it now stands in Illinois.
What were your reasons for standing in the execution chamber, and what was the impact of that on your thinking?
Well, the execution chamber I wanted to see as a member of the commission. I've never seen an execution, I was grateful, frankly, that I didn't have the opportunity while I was sitting on the commission, because I probably would have forced myself to take advantage of it. But I wanted to go to the death chamber in Illinois to get to just sort of confront this, because the fact of the matter is that this is an enormously cruel punishment as it is imposed. You take people who've done in many, many instances, unspeakable things. But they have been subdued at that point. Many of them actually changed their behavior in the structure of a prison environment. And, you know, you take a subdued, captured individual and kill him. And it's deeply unsettling to the correctional officers who are involved in this, and that's not to gainsay their belief in capital punishment. I think for most of them, they do believe in what they're doing. But even the ones who don't believe in it, the warden down at the TAMS facility, George Welburn, remarked to me, and George has presided over a number of executions, he said, if I don't ever have to do another one, that's fine with me. It's very hard on the personnel who carry it out, and I wanted to confront that aspect of the system.
Scott Turow will talk more about rethinking the death penalty in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of A Matter of Dignity, Changing the World of the Disabled by Andrew Potok, author of Ordinary Daylight. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, visiting death row to see the so-called poster child for capital punishment, we continue our conversation with Scott Turow, and we talk with Illinois State's Attorney Mike Wallace. Both served on Illinois Governor George Ryan's commission recommending reforms to the state's capital punishment system. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Scott Turow. He's a lawyer and the author of several best-selling legal thrillers, including Presumed Innocent. His new book, Reversible Errors, is about a lawyer trying to exonerate a prisoner on death row. Turow recently served on the Illinois State Commission to investigate the fairness of the death penalty. When we left off, he was telling us why he wanted to visit death row. I know one of the people you visited on death row was Henry Brisbon. Who is he? Why'd you visit him?
Well, Henry Brisbon tends to be the poster child for capital punishment in Illinois. When you talk to law enforcement professionals, people in the correctional system, prosecutors, police officers, they always point to Brisbon because in addition to having been convicted twice of murder, one set of serial murders and another prison murder, he's got an atrocious disciplinary record, over 250 disciplinary incidents, many of them involving, serious acts of alleged violence, stabbings, hitting correctional officers with 2x4s, throwing a 30-pound dumbbell against the head of another inmate, severely injuring him, at least according to the prison officials' allegations. So he is somebody whose propensity to violence and to murder is very well demonstrated. And certainly if you're going to execute anybody, somebody who is a sort of living threat ought to be at the top of the list. So I wanted to meet Brisbon, but more important, look at the Supermax facility at Tams, the southern part of Illinois, just to see if it really was possible to restrain the likes of Brisbon with conditions of confinement. In other words, because if you can't, I was prepared to say that execution in those cases really seems to me to be just, and if not inevitable.
So did you feel he was adequately controlled at this prison?
My judgment, and based really on talking with the correctional officials I did, was that the risks are enormously mitigated. Somebody with the kind of track record that Brisbon has is not someone with whom correctional officers are ever comfortable saying he'll never kill again. But they acknowledge that the odds are dramatically reduced, and certainly they're reduced enough that they're comfortable walking into the institution every day. So I think in practical terms, supermax confinement, which is very, very rugged,
Why don't you describe how that applies to Brisbon's situation? What was the supermax aspects of it? What kind of...
Well, supermax is what it means. Generally speaking, prisoners in the TAMS facility and other supermaxes across the United States are permitted no flesh-to-flesh contact with other human beings. That means if things go as intended, once you are sent to a supermax and until you are allowed to leave there, you never touch another human being. In Illinois, they are in cells with a punch plate front, which prevents them from being able to put their hands between bars and do any mayhem that way. It's a small box of preformed concrete. I've forgotten the dimensions exactly. I'd say roughly 8x10. There's almost nothing in there except a single fixture, which is a combination toilet and sink, and a foam mattress over a concrete pallet. Once a day, for about 45 minutes, the door is opened by remote control. You can go out down the end of the galleyway to another remote-controlled door and take fresh air. Then you go back to your cell, and five times a week you also get 15 minutes to shower. And the cell itself, as I said, is, there is a single window which is up high. It's very narrow. This is not comfortable living in any way, shape, or form.
John Ashcroft is insisting that federal prosecutors seek the death penalty in some cases where the prosecutors had not sought it or had recommended against it. And this is mostly going on in the Northeast. New York, I think Connecticut is the other state. What's your interpretation of what Ashcroft is doing and why he's doing it?
I think the Attorney General can look at what's happening and realize that the death penalty is not being sought by federal prosecutors on a reasoned and consistent basis. And so he's forcing them to apply it more often in the hope that it will become more reasonable and more consistent. And this is a fairly typical response. It's where Illinois was after the reenactment of the death penalty in 1977. And the result is you become over-inclusive in the application of the death penalty. You begin applying it, in point of fact, to cases where subordinate prosecutors have said the death penalty ought not be applied. How that ends up being more just is really confounding to me. You force the line prosecutor's hand, say, you've got to seek death in this case, and the line prosecutor is already on the record saying, well, we shouldn't do it. And again, I don't know if that makes the people who are listening here feel more confident about the application of the death penalty.
Now that we're facing terrorisms and trials of people accused of terrorism, is your thinking related to terrorism and the death penalty any different from your thinking pertaining to criminal trials, basic criminal trials and the death penalty?
Well, you know, when you say the state should not kill, the next question is, well, what do you do about war? And I do accept war as inevitable. As a lawyer, I say that the issue of capital punishment is whether the state should kill its own citizens, not whether it should kill its foreign enemies. Sometimes it has to do that, and for that reason, I draw a lawyerly distinction between domestic crime and acts of foreign terrorism.
So you could endorse a death penalty for foreign terrorists who've committed actions against the United States sooner than for American criminals?
I think the question of whether we execute Osama bin Laden is a much different question than whether we execute the people on our death rows.
Now that you've served on the commission to reform the death penalty, is the kind of case that you want to take on different?
Well, actually, my own desire is I want to get out of the world of capital punishment, both as a writer and as a lawyer for a while. It's very, very consuming emotionally. And I would like to move on into other matters.
Yeah, your new novel has to do with capital punishment.
Right.
And is that a result of having served on this commission? Which came first, Reversible Errors, your new novel, or the commission?
No, actually, the Reversible Errors was the one impediment to my accepting a place on the commission when it was suggested that I might be considered. Because I'd already started the novel, and that sprang from 10 years of experience as a lawyer involved with capital prosecutions, and ultimately I think we all sat down and figured, well, there is no actual conflict here. But I resolved personally that I wouldn't publish Reversible Errors until after the commission had issued its report.
Well, Scott Turow, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Scott Turow is a lawyer and best-selling novelist. His latest legal thriller is called Reversible Errors. Coming up, we talk with Lake County, Illinois State's Attorney Michael Waller, who also served on the commission to investigate the fairness of the death penalty. He continues to support capital punishment. This is Fresh Air. Before leaving office last month, Illinois Governor George Ryan commuted the sentences of all prisoners on the state's death row. 2 years earlier, the governor imposed a moratorium on executions and appointed a commission to investigate the fairness of the death penalty system. Earlier, we spoke with Scott Turow about serving on the commission and how the experience led him to oppose the death penalty. Mike Waller served on the commission and continues to support the death penalty. Waller is the Lake County State's Attorney. It's the third largest county in Illinois. I asked Waller about the commission's recommendation to limit the kinds of cases eligible for the death penalty.
Well, the majority on the Death Penalty Commission of the governor's commission voted to restrict the number of eligibility factors in Illinois, basically limiting them to five. Probably the single most significant factor that was eliminated by the majority in the commission report was the total elimination of felony murder.
What does that mean practically?
Well, that means a murder committed in the course of a kidnapping or a home invasion or a rape or an abduction of a child would no longer be eligible for the death penalty under Illinois law if the recommendation of the majority, the Death Penalty Commission, was adopted by the legislature.
And do you agree with that recommendation?
No, I voted against that. And what the majority did, in essence, was to remove the most brutal and vicious types of murders from eligibility for potential death penalty. My view is that if you're going to have the death penalty, that you certainly the death penalty should apply to those types of murders. I mean, we had a case of a defendant in Illinois who subsequently was executed, who abducted a young woman and raped her continuously. He actually had her in the trunk of his car when he went to court here in Chicago, and it was one of the most brutal and vicious murders, and it was just terrifying for this the poor victim in this case. And under the recommendation of the majority, that would not be a death penalty eligible case. You know, you can also get to the issue of whether you should have a death penalty, and I suspect that maybe the legislature in Illinois is going to debate that now because of what Governor Ryan did. But, you know, if you are going to have a death penalty, in my view, it needs to be applicable to the most horrendous types of murders.
Now, you've prosecuted a lot of capital cases. One of the arguments that is often made against the death penalty is that a lot of people who face the death penalty are poor and they can't afford a really good defense. And therefore, the best case isn't made on their behalf and they're more likely to get convicted. Have you ever tried a case where you could tell that the lawyer defending the person wasn't really doing a very good job, and so convicting the person was kind of a piece of cake for you?
No.
Did you ever walk away with doubts, thinking that you won because of the incompetence of the lawyer who was defending? No.
No. In my county, and I've tried four death penalty cases, the judges have always appointed two qualified, experienced lawyers, which is in conformity with longstanding ABA guidelines. And they've always provided sufficient funds so the defense can hire experts and do whatever investigation is necessary. So my experience in Lake County has been that it's been an even playing field and the sides have been evenly matched. But what happened in Illinois was as a result of a very intelligent and concerted effort that all of the cases over the course of the 25 years since the death penalty was reinstituted were all lumped together. And the horror stories that existed with some of the cases, and there certainly were some problem cases, and we study those in detail, as I mentioned, on the Death Penalty Commission, but they were all lumped together with cases where there wasn't any issue as to guilt or innocence, and there wasn't any issue as to competent defense attorney or sufficient funding made available so that the defense could explore defenses and provide a reasonable defense to the case.
How many of the people who you've convicted have actually been executed?
Well, not that I personally prosecuted, none have, but two Lake County cases since the death penalty was reinstituted in 1977 in Illinois have resulted in executions.
And you went to one of those executions?
Right. One of the defendants was convicted and given a death penalty in three states, and he was executed, but he was executed in Ohio. He wasn't executed in Illinois. The other defendant from a Lake County case was executed in Illinois, and I did go to the execution.
Why'd you go?
I went because as the state's attorney in Lake County, I made the decision, although I was not the state's attorney when he was tried, but I was the state's attorney for most of the time when the case was in litigation. And as you know, the guilty verdict and the imposition of the death penalty is really only the start of the legal process in a death penalty case. So I had made the decisions throughout that this was a case, and I had gone down to what used to be the last step in the capital litigation process is a hearing before the Prisoner Review Board in which the defendant requests clemency from the governor. I had gone down and testified and presented the case, and I thought as the state's attorney, the person who was ultimately responsible for the decision, that I should go to the execution. It was certainly not something that I took any pleasure in doing or did for any other reason than I thought it was my responsibility and duty to do it. I can remember clearly the events of that evening and probably always will.
What kind of execution was it? Electric chair or lethal injection?
No, it was lethal injection.
Many critics of the death penalty, including Scott Turow, feel that the death penalty has never been administered fairly, that there are racial differences, gender differences, class differences, rural versus urban differences, and that all those inequities within the system make it impossible to support the death penalty. Do you agree that there are inequities within how the death penalty is administered, and how does that figure into your opinion on the death penalty, your support of it?
Well, I think there's some differences in different parts of the state as to how the death penalty is administered. That has not affected my support for the death penalty. I am a state's attorney in a county that's very diverse, and I actually seek the death penalty infrequently. I was the first assistant state's attorney for a number of years before I became a state's attorney, and my predecessor, Fred Foreman, did not seek the death penalty very often. We're very careful. We look for reasons not to seek the death penalty. It's sometimes hard to counter the arguments of the people that are against the death penalty because they sort of lump everything together. I suppose that if the only way to really fairly administer the death penalty is to seek it much more often for every defendant that commits one of these terrible crimes. The fact of the matter is that a lot of times decisions are made not to seek the death penalty in cases that the death penalty could be obtained, which in my view is not necessarily a bad thing, but on the other hand, it's then used by the anti-death penalty people to say, aha, this is not fairly administered. So you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't, if you're the people making the if you're the person making the decision as far as a death penalty when dealing with the anti-death penalty people. And I don't begrudge the people that are against death penalty. I think there's certainly a very significant issue. And, we're probably the only modern industrial Western state that has the death penalty. But that's a issue that needs to be debated in the legislature.
Were you offended or angry when Governor Ryan turned around the death penalty?
Yes, I was. I was offended, and I suppose I was angry in what he did. What he did really undid 25 years of litigation, and like I mentioned, he lumped together all the cases, and he had preceded his decision by, in Illinois, we have a process where there's a petition for clemency is filed, and we had hearings in 140-some-odd cases this fall, which involved a tremendous amount of work and involved a tremendous amount of heartache and emotional reaction on the part of the family members of the victims. And all this evidence was presented to the Prisoner Review Board, which made recommendations to the governor, and according to the reports, although the specific recommendations are confidential, they recommended that no action or no commutation be taken in the overwhelming majority of the cases. And according to published reports, that they recommended that there be some action taken in fewer than 10 cases. And then Ryan, who had continuously assured everybody that he wasn't going to issue blanket commutation, did. And the way he did it was to hold like a pep rally at Northwestern University, which was televised on TV, And it was just, it was very, very poorly thought out, considered, and the way he did it was, I described it as a travesty of justice, which I think it it was and it is.
Is there a part of you that respects the governor for acting on his conscience, even though you disagree with him?
I'm not sure that he, you know, if everything you read about him and see the way he administered things and the way he ran the office of Secretary of State and the way he acted as governor, if a governor like Jim Edgar or Jim Thompson, whose integrity and credibility is unquestioned, had made the decision, I think maybe I would say, okay, I disagree with him, but I certainly respect him. But I will only say that I disagree with George Ryan, and I have no respect for his decision.
My guest is Mike Waller, Lake County, Illinois, state's attorney. We'll talk more about the death penalty after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Waller, Lake County, Illinois, state's attorney. We're talking about his experiences serving on a commission appointed by Illinois Governor George Ryan to investigate the fairness of the death penalty system. Last month, just before leaving office, the governor commuted the sentences of all prisoners on death row. Since everybody on death row had their death sentences commuted by Governor Ryan, if you get a case tomorrow that you think should be tried as a capital case, would you go for the death penalty or just not bother?
Well, what I will do and what I have done, and we've actually had one case since then where I made the decision, is to use the same approach that I've always used, which is to thoroughly investigate the facts and circumstances of the case and thoroughly investigate the background of the defendant, to consult with everybody involved in the case and then make a decision. And actually, I did that in a case that after Ryan commuted the sentences of the 167 people on death row, and my decision was not to seek the death penalty. But it's my approach to this is going to be the same as it's always been, is to try to make a reasoned and informed judgment. And it's not just, you know, don't bother, because it's too serious and difficult of a question. And in the appropriate case, I would seek the death penalty.
Attorney General John Ashcroft is insisting that the death penalty be applied in 10 cases in New York, even though the U.S. attorneys there decided to forego the death penalty. And Ashcroft is overturning what they wanted. What's your opinion about how he is handling this, and what do you think the point of it is?
Well, I think he should rely on the judgment of the U.S. attorneys in the districts that made those decisions. They're in much closer contact with the facts of the case and probably the realistic possibility of receiving the death penalty. I think Ashcroft ought to defer to their considered judgment. He obviously has his own agenda.
It seems to you like an agenda, and what do you think the agenda is?
Well, he's obviously very pro-death penalty. I mean, I personally, having made the decision and having had a great deal of experience, don't think that he ought to countermand the considered judgment of the U.S. attorneys that made those decisions. They're not exactly bleeding heart liberals, I'm confident that they looked at all the facts and circumstances and a lot of other issues involved in it and made a reasonable decision. And I think Ashcroft should have gone along with it.
You served on Governor Ryan's commission to reform the death penalty. What do you think is the greatest contribution that commission made?
Well, I think that the report and the issues that we discussed certainly provide a framework for a discussion about all the issues that surround and impact the death penalty. And it'll be the basis for discussion here in Illinois and in other parts of the country. But the fact of the matter is that to the people that are against the death penalty, none of this makes any difference, because the only thing that they want to see happen is not to have a death penalty, which, again, as I've said, I think a couple of times, is a reasonable view to have. And if the legislature and this state decided that we weren't going to have a death penalty, that would be the law, and that would be fine with me. When I first worked as a prosecutor in the 1970s, we didn't have a death penalty. And, you know, the system operated fine, and cases were effectively prosecuted, and the lack of a death penalty did not hamstring the system.
Did you prefer working in an environment where you didn't have that on your head, where it wasn't your responsibility to decide whether or not you should call for taking somebody's life?
I wasn't the person making the decisions in those days, but it certainly was easier to be the state's attorney in a state or at a time when we didn't have the death penalty than when we do have the death penalty, because the most difficult decision that a state's attorney or a district attorney or a prosecutor ever has to make is whether or not to seek the death penalty. But that, as far as preferring it, you know, I took an oath to enforce the law, and that's the law of the state of Illinois, so I feel that it's my duty and my obligation to consider that in the appropriate circumstances.
Well, Mike Waller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, well, thank you.
Mike Waller is the Lake County, Illinois state's attorney. He served on the Governor's Commission to investigate the fairness of the death penalty system. Earlier, we heard from Scott Turow, who also served on the commission. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Universal Pictures, presenting The Life of David Gale, starring Kevin Spacey, Kate Winslet, and Laura Linney, directed by Alan Parker, in theaters Friday, and from Harcourt, publisher of Looking for Spinoza, about the importance of emotions in human life and culture, by neuroscientist Antonio Damasio, author of The Feeling of What Happens. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, how the U.S. military is preparing for war in Iraq. We talk with Washington Post reporters Thomas Ricks and Vernon Loeb. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.